This is episode number 36 with Srini Rao.
Welcome to the Rise Higher podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie Kwong, and each week I'll bring you an inspiring guest with an empowering message to help you rise higher and live your best life. Each guest shares their time of struggle and setback and what specific mindsets, tools, practices, or habits they use to overcome so that you can apply them to your life. This show is to remind you that you're not alone and that there's always a pathway up. Thanks for spending some time with me today. I'm grateful to be on this journey with you. Our struggles are a call for us to rise. So here we go. Let's dive deep now so we can rise higher together. Hello, my friends, and welcome back to the Rise Higher podcast. In today's episode, I have got the founder and host of the highly acclaimed Unmistakable Creative Podcast, Srini Rao. Now, Srini has also written three books. He wrote the Wall Street Journal bestseller, The Art of Being Unmistakable, Unmistakable, Why Only is Better Than Best, and he also wrote An Audience of One, Reclaiming Creativity for Its Own Sake. And his work has been featured in the New York Times, Forbes Inc., Business Insider, and The Blaze. Now, today, we've got a whole lot of goodness for you. We are talking about everything from paving your own path instead of following the status quo, to the power of surrender, the importance of releasing expectations, the downsides of technology and social media, to ways to increase your personal energy and create new habits. Now, as I said, we've got a whole lot of goodness for you. Now, on Srini's Unmistakable podcast, he's interviewed so many amazing thought leaders and people from all walks of life that he's overflowing with incredible advice and insights into some of the biggest challenges that we all face, like self-doubt, comparison, jealousy, and lack of motivation. And Srini's got a lot of wisdom to share with you from his own personal experiences. And he goes into detail about how surfing and the ocean have been one of his greatest teachers. Now, Srini also talks about how he overcame a time of depression to rise up even higher. And it's so inspiring to hear him detail his path from depression to peace and success. Now, I've pretty much shared the keys, things that we chat about. But to detail it just a little bit more, some of the things that we cover in today's episode are the importance of letting go of expectations, how you're affected by the energy of your environment, the number one issue with starting your day with social media, the subtle and obvious ways in which energy impacts your day-to-day, how being present can motivate you and prevent disappointments, the power behind technology detoxes, how to stop comparing yourself to others, and key steps to take to build new positive habits, and of course, so much more. Now, I would love to hear what you guys think of this episode. Please make sure you take a screenshot of the podcast that you're listening to. Tag me on Instagram at I am Stephanie Kwong, and please share this with your friends. Okay, if you're ready, let's get moving with Srini. We got Srini in the house! Srini, thank you so much for being on the Rise Higher podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I know you are a man in demand. And so the fact that you said yes and hopped on, and I know you have so much to share. I've been doing my due diligence and learning so much about you. And actually, I feel like I know you just based off of researching about you. And the more that I'm learning, really inspired.
You're horrified.
Yes, horrification. No, but I know we have a lot of mutual friends too who've spoken so highly of you, but I'm just really inspired by your story, what you've created, and I'm looking forward to sharing that today on the show.
Thanks.
Yeah. And I know, and I just want to hop right in because I know this is such a huge part of your story is surfing, right? Mm-hmm. And you talk about it in your book, and a big key element that I have personally been moving past and beyond is letting go of expectation.
Yeah.
I think that sets a lot of people up for feeling disappointed, feeling frustrated, or even feeling
reinforcing whatever stories they might have around feeling not good enough, or I'm not fill in the blank enough, right? Yeah. Smart enough, capable enough. And yet there's so much to learn from what you experienced from surfing and how that's been a metaphor for life on how to approach things so that you don't create that pain for yourself. So I'd love for you to share maybe, you know, where you were before you started surfing and then how that led you to where you are today.
Yeah, I think this is such a fitting question because it's a struggle that I've actually been going through again lately with my latest book, which hasn't quite lived up to my expectations, but we'll get there. I graduated from business school April 2009. I happened to be going to school at Pepperdine, which was right near the beach. And I did a study abroad in Brazil. And 2 weeks before I came home, I stood up on a surfboard for the first time. And it was just this sort of religious experience. It was kind of, I felt this lightness that I had never felt in the past 10 years because I had really bad stomach problems, almost all probably stress induced. And I remember getting out of the water and the only thought going through my mind was, wow, I want to feel this way all the time. And so when I got back to Malibu, unlike most people, when my financial aid check got deposited, I went to the surf shop and bought a board and a wetsuit instead of going to the bookstore and buying books. And so that kind of began this sort of journey that has now lasted, I think at the end of this year, it'll be 10 years. I started surfing between classes and I wasn't any good. And then I graduated and I had all this free time because I couldn't find a job. It was a really bad time to be looking for a job. And, you know, this business that I've built hadn't started yet. So I was literally like, okay, I got to find a job. I got to figure out how to get my life together. But I needed something to do to pass the time. And surfing ended up being that thing because it's a perfect hobby for an unemployed person because it takes a shitload of time and it doesn't cost any money. You could spend hours on end doing it, which is why, you know, I think that somewhat rightfully so, surfers have the reputation of being beach bums. Because I remember by the end of that summer, my mom being an Indian mom and you being Asian probably can relate to this. Every day I came home, all my parents was like, fuck, you're getting darker. Like that would be the only comment I'd ever hear from any Indian person. So I was like, damn it, you're getting darker. And, you know, but the thing is that during what should have been a really, really depressing time period in which I was struggling to find a job and you know, nobody gets out of grad school thinking, oh, I'm going to be unemployed and living at my parents' house after grad school. But surfing ended up being this thing that made that whole experience a lot less depressing. It was something that made me really happy. But I think that part of immersing yourself in an environment like the ocean, what's special about it is that really kind of forces you to surrender to things that you have absolutely no control over. Like that is one of the biggest lessons that comes from it. And I don't know that I've ever articulated it this way until you asked that question, but you go into the water and I remember this just a Sunday night. I was with my former business partner, Brian, and we were in the middle of deep in the middle of a conversation and, you know, like really, really deep into it. Next thing you know, we're both getting our asses handed to us. And I finally make it back to the takeoff point. And Brian says, the ocean just doesn't give a fuck, does it? No, it really doesn't. It is such a profound metaphor for life because there are so many things that are out of your control. And the funny thing is we're talking about expectations in particular. We went to that surf session thinking, okay, Surf Report says it's shitty, no expectations. Then we got there and we were pleasantly surprised. We were watching people catch these like really long, perfect waves. And we're thinking to ourselves, all right, if I get one of those, it'll be a good session. And of course, you know, we got a couple of them, but we were getting our asses handed to us in between. And so as a result of that, you realize that this element is constantly changing, constantly dynamic. You know, one day it's flat and the next day, you know, you've got 6 foot waves that are coming in sets. I remember going to this beach in Nicaragua once where I almost drowned and I went back there 2 or 3 years later and I paddled out thinking, I was like, how is this the same beach? There's like 2 foot waves versus 13 foot waves. And so I think that in addition to teaching you how to handle an unpredictable environment and making you recognize that life is dynamic and life is unpredictable, you learn a bunch of other lessons. You have to learn how to be present. You have to learn to get back up after you fall, which happens constantly. You have to learn how to take waves on the head and kind of recover from it. So I think really more than anything, probably the biggest lesson, there are two things I think that have come from my experience as a surfer when it comes to this idea of expectations. One is presence. I think presence really helps us to let go of expectations, because if you think about expectations, expectations are literally not something in the moment. They're about something that's going to happen in the future. So this recent book launch is an example where, as much as I talked about this idea of an audience of one, in my mind, of course, I'm thinking, oh, how awesome would it be if, you know, we sold several thousand copies or hit a New York Times bestseller list, and, you know, you're sort of future projecting. And as a result, this thing doesn't meet your expectations and you get disappointed. And you know, like I said, in this book in particular, it's been a really interesting lesson, because that's the entire message of the book. And so, you know, at moments I'm kind of like, wow, I need this message more than the people who probably I wrote it for. And so, and, you know, I finally got to a point where I had to let it go. I mean, I had a good month where the expectations really were just making me really depressed, because we invested in a really big marketing firm for this who did their job. They did a fantastic job. But the thing they also told me, you know, when I asked them, what can we expect? They said, Srini, we can't commit to, you know, X number of book sales. It's just not, we don't want to do that. And I don't blame them. Like, nobody can say, okay, you're going to get this. And then you have sort of, you know, what they call a perennial seller, which doesn't become popular in the moment, but years from now, or continues to sell throughout time. And that's one, you know, sort of thing that's happened with my own expectations, is I adjusted them to say, okay, you know what? We're selling 50 to 60 copies a week. That's pretty damn good, considering most people never sell more than 1,000 copies of their book.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch of places we can go with this, but that's kind of what I've learned about expectations. I think that the ocean is this place that sort of, it forces presence on you, and it kind of just, it levels everything out. I always notice that I'm in a better mood after I get out of the water. Everything that was really stressing me out, I realized even just this Sunday, it had been a long time since I had a really good surf session, and I got out of the water and I remember just driving down PCH with, you know, music blaring, with sunroof down. And I was like, okay, you know what? This doesn't suck. This is pretty awesome.
How, and then I'm curious for you, because here's the thing, 10 years is a long time. You've built some mastery clearly around surfing. And what I just want to highlight just even about life is, you know, even with mastery, you're still going to get beat up. It doesn't mean that you're going to go out and surf perfectly every single time. Depends on the conditions, and it's how you pivot, right? Or able to manage yourself in the getting the shit beat out of you. And so even on the days when you get knocked down and it's not the best, do you still feel fulfilled with your surf session?
So I have days when I get out. There are days when I can't even get past the white water because there's just so much water moving. And those days I've just been like, you know what? It's not meant to be today. Do I still get out fulfilled? No, not necessarily. I get out kind of irritated that I spent 3 hours of my day trying to do it. But I also know that here's the thing. If you only show up when the conditions are perfect, then you're not going to be ready for those moments when they are, because you're not getting practice, right? So if you look at the way I built my body of work and the way that I've done everything is almost entirely through habit and practice, because I don't think any of it comes from natural talent, and particularly when it comes to surfing. I mean, I'm Indian. I'm not genetically predisposed for any sort of athletic stardom, which I learned from playing seventh grade football. So, but the beauty of action sports, particularly like surfing and snowboarding, is if you're dragging ass, it's not like a basketball court where you cause the performance of everybody else on the team to suffer. The only person who you're competing against is yourself. And so that's another really useful way of looking at pretty much everything in life, right? Because nowadays, particularly because our lives are so publicly on display, it makes it really easy to feel that we're in this constant competition with other people. And that's something that I even struggle with. Like I just interviewed James Clear about his new book. And I remember thinking, I was like, damn, this guy's book hasn't even come out yet. And it's already sold 6,000 copies. And that moment, I'm kind of like, okay, I'm a masterful interviewer. James happens to be masterful at writing, but I don't recognize, you know, what I have as an interviewer, because I'm envious of the fact that he sold 6,000 books before the damn thing even came out. And that's what happens when we sort of lose presence and we get into this sort of mode of comparison. But I think that when you start to realize that, okay, really at the end of the day, the only person you're competing against, the only person worth competing against is yourself.
I would say you and your past self, right? Like growth is everything.
Exactly.
And it's like, how do I evolve and get to the next level versus how do I outdo other people?
Totally.
And that's a way of keeping some peace in your mind, I gotta say.
Yeah.
So with this book, and when I do want to talk about it as well, an audience of one, when you had that expectation, and clearly you've been able to learn a lot from surfing and how to manage the expectation in a certain way, how are you able then to bring yourself to a place of peace and manage the expectation you had around the results of the book, the book or number that were sold for you?
Yeah. So that's a good question. And you know, I think I'm still kind of I'm making my way out of that expectation right now. But I think what it came down to was this just sort of sense of surrender of saying, okay, you know what? Like, I realized I've been fighting so hard and resisting so hard the fact that it hadn't sold as many copies as I wanted to. And I said, well, that's not really causing it to sell any more copies, is it? Like, what's the point of this? Like, this is an utterly like, you know, it's just a complete waste of energy and effort. And it's such a mental drain. And so I think that really what it comes down to is this idea of surrender, right? Like accepting the circumstances of your life. That's one of the strange paradoxes of change is that we can't change anything until we accept the circumstances. It's even, you know, in the ocean when you're fighting against the white water desperately, what you don't realize is that, wait a minute, like all these waves are going to stop eventually and I'm going to be able to just paddle out to the takeoff point. But what we do is we waste all this energy trying to get back to like this place where we can catch a wave. When all this water is coming at us, when if we were to just sort of say, okay, you know what, I'm just going to wait for a bit, all of it stops and you can be out there in like 2 minutes. So I think part of what happens when you start to accept the circumstances of your life and you kind of surrender to them is that you start to find a lot more clarity because you're no longer caught up in like the fear, the panic, the anxiety, and the disappointment that often comes from expectations. And so and the thing that I want to make sure we are clear on, though, is that there's a difference between surrender and resignation, right? So
people
often will mix up those two things. And I would say, you know, for a while, it was kind of like, okay, I've resigned myself to the fact that that's it. Like, this is how many copies the book is going to sell. Whereas once you get to a place of surrender, you start asking very different questions. You know, I said, okay, we sold 50 copies a week. So I went to my content strategist and I said, okay, how do we maintain this 50 copies a week? Like, what can we do to ensure that every week when we send out emails to our newsletter, we're still selling books? Like, what else could we keep doing? And suddenly, like, all these answers start to come to you. So I think that it's this just balancing act. And again, you know, like there's a quote in the book. I don't remember the exact quote. It was from Ryan Holiday when he talked about the fact that you know, one of the hardest things to do is separate your effort from the results of the work that you do, because there's so many things that are out of your control. So if somebody screws something up, for example, we had a lot of interviews that didn't drop when we thought they were going to. And usually people are adamant. Authors will try to get everybody to publish interviews in the same week because you want that surround sound effect so that this book is everywhere. And you have a chance of potentially pushing it up in the Amazon sales. But sometimes you're not in control of that. And so it's stuff like that, that you just kind of have to make your peace with. But I think it's really a practice. It's a lot of this is easy to say and it's hard to do. It's funny because I mean, I get advice like this all day long from podcast guests. I mean, if I were able to literally implement every single thing every one of my guests has told me, I would be like Elon Musk. I'd be like superhuman, worth billions of dollars, in the best shape of my life, and have women knocking down my door, you know, to date me. But that's not reality. Like, I think that we all have different strengths and weaknesses. And part of it is looking at, okay, where am I strong and where am I weak? And saying, okay, let me do the things that amplify my strengths. So, you know, that's not the most prescriptive answer, but that's kind of what I have.
You know, I really love that. And I think, again, the key piece is the distinction of resignation and the surrender part. Surrender is actually a very courageous act, I see. The willingness to be at peace with what is, right? The acceptance part. And then keep moving in the face of it, right? Of whatever is in front of you. And I think for some, even the expectation, because then people go, well, I just don't want to have any expectation then.
Yeah.
Then you're losing the sight of the goal. It's like you still have to aim for something. So like the expectation is what am I shooting for? But not being attached to how the results look and how the results show up. Because many times I know for me, I'll think that it's supposed to look a certain way on how I'm supposed to get there or how it's supposed to be. But when I just like surrender, meaning I let go of the exact how or the way it's supposed to look, I'm most oftentimes surprised by, holy shit, this is way even better than I could have even imagined.
Oh, yeah.
Or if it's still not what I wanted and I can perceive the result as sucky, it's like, okay, what can I learn from this, which is still value added to your life. So, yeah, still shooting for something and not just going, well, then I'm not going to have an expectation to shoot for or like something to move towards. But it's in the face of what we don't truly desire, can we be in acceptance of that and still Yeah, surrender to it and then keep going.
Well, it's funny because I've had that happen so many times in my life. I remember in 2013, I had this freelance writing job for this website, Search Engine Journal. And the editor at Search Engine Journal, after about 3 months and, you know, paying me a couple, like a grand a month to just write an article a week, she came to me and she said, hey, we're going to let you go. And she let me go, not because I was doing a bad job. She said, you're outgrowing this. And she's like, I think we need to find somebody who fits this. She's like, you're going to outgrow this in no time. Like, it was very clear that I was getting well ahead of where I think she expected somebody to be. And what ended up happening right after I let go, you know, and so right when we lose something, I think when we lose anything, whether that be a romantic partner, a job opportunity, or a business opportunity, like what we tend to do is we tend to cling onto it. We tend to grasp. And it was one of the handful of times in my life where I was somehow hyper aware enough not to do that and just to say, you know what, fine, let it go. And I think 3 weeks later, I self-published my first book, The Art of Being Unmistakable, and that thing ended up selling 15,000 copies. And like, you know, whatever money I lost from that freelance writing gig, I got back, you know, like 100 times over the last 2 years between a book deal with a publisher. It was kind of like, wow, okay. So I try to always remember that when something doesn't go my way, that, okay, you know what, like whatever I lost here was replaced by something far greater.
Yeah. So I want to deep dive into a different point of time in your life where expectation or things just went south, right? And then how did you discover what was far greater in that time?
Yeah.
So I know, was it back in 2014, right? When you went through a state of depression because things just went.
Yeah. So here's the interesting thing about achieving a bunch of really amazing things at once. Like, so I was thinking about this the other day. Like most people, when they see people achieve some level of success, they assume that there are like no downsides to this, right? Like that there literally is nothing bad that comes, you know, in this position. I was thinking about this yesterday as I was on my flight back from Iowa. So if you think about somebody like Mark Zuckerberg, right, who's a billionaire, who's like, you know, literally on the cover of magazines, who's, you know, built Facebook into this empire, unless he's a total like sociopath with zero empathy, I'm pretty much willing to bet there's not a day that goes by that he has remorse about how things turned out between him and his friend Eduardo. Like, that's a pretty significant loss. Like, you can't, no matter how rich he is, you can't put a price on the fact that that friendship was completely destroyed by this business. And so people don't see that there are downsides to these things. So, you know, I want to preface it by saying that. But so, yeah, you know, we were sort of on this rocket ride to the moon in 2013. You know, we sold out an event in 2 weeks that by all accounts was a massive success. You know, 60 attendees, 9 speakers. You know, we launched Unmistakable Creative. In the span of like 3 months, I self-published a book that became a Wall Street Journal bestseller. I went from having $600 in the bank to $120,000 in the bank, most of it, which was money for our event. But still, like, to see that transformation. And then, you know, we launched Unmistakable Creative. And then in the span of like 3 weeks, the event was over. A girl that I was seeing broke up with me. Our sponsors didn't renew our contracts. It was just like all at once. And so we went from like an extreme high to an extreme low. And that kind of just sent me into a really bad tailspin. It also made me hyper aware of my own behavior online in terms of what I saw. Like, I looked at, you know, the situation with this long distance relationship just from a pure neurological standpoint, using Facebook constantly. And I thought, wow, okay, you've basically cut a rat off a dopamine supply that was endless for months on end. Any normal person would go into a depression after that because you've done some serious neurological damage. Like, I didn't recognize it at the time. Now I do, which is why I'm so like hypercritical of all things social media, which we can talk about. But anyways, so, you know, right. And as we're thinking, you know, the year can't get worse. We tried to launch the event a second time. Not enough people bought tickets. We ended up pulling the plug in 2015. But then slowly, what was interesting is right after we pulled the plug on that event, I think a month later, my editor at Penguin contacted me about writing a book. And so I lost an event, got a book deal. And it was kind of like, okay, you know what? Like, I lost something here that really mattered to me and I've never been able to pull it off again. Like, I've wanted to, I've made, you know, one other attempt to pull off a conference. And the thing is that I also know the way that I would do something like that, it's not something I think you can do every year, just because we pretty much, I mean, you could ask anybody who's been to any of our events. It's kind of like, we don't pull any punches. I mean, literally, it's like, okay, what do people expect and how do we exceed that expectation at every turn from the moment they walk in the door to the moment that they leave? All our name tags were custom illustrated, like our venues weren't hotels. It was literally every moment of, okay, what how do we shatter people's expectations? Somebody, you know, in our Facebook group for the event once said, you know, I feel like you're trying to ruin every other event we're ever going to go to. And I was like, yeah, absolutely.
That's the goal.
That's the standard by which we do things. And that's an incredibly draining way to operate. The other thing is that, you know, you also get clarity about what really works, and it's not a profitable way to run a business. I mean, that thing would have been a loss leader for us. I mean, we didn't lose money the first time, but I think that that made me hyper aware of a lot of different things, like the power of, you know, how your environment can change your behavior, the people that you surround yourself with. But again, you know, none of these things come without sort of collateral damage in a lot of ways. I think I lost a lot of friendships through that period. You know, you may have seen it. We did this animated series with Soul Pancake where we took some of our most poetic stuff and brought it to life on a YouTube channel that, you know, aired. But what a lot of people don't know is that there was a lot of drama around that, most of which we weren't allowed to talk about, because the moment lawyers get involved in anything, like, everybody gets silenced. People get paid off, but it doesn't matter because the damage is already done. And so you don't see that often, despite accomplishing these things, they come at a cost of other things in your life. So that's kind of, you know, as far as how I got through it, I think, you know, friends were a really important one. But the role of physical environment is something that I'm hyper aware of at this point, and it's probably one of the most powerful concepts that I've ever been exposed to.
Mm-hmm. Say more about that. Like the physical environment, how is that? Okay, go ahead.
So this will blow your mind, because there's so much good stuff in here and I think that it's funny. I think that women have an intuitive understanding of the fact that environment has a huge impact on the way that you feel. That's why if you notice, like, once a guy starts dating somebody, his house suddenly looks a lot nicer. The bathrooms are a lot cleaner. Like, I've noticed that with all my friends who are in relationships. I went over to a friend's house the other day, and I looked around and I was like, okay, I can sense that, you know, a woman's touch has been infused into this place. I think women have a much more intuitive understanding of this. I have an intuitive understanding of it because my mom is insane and she insists that the house look like Buckingham Palace. Now I get it. Now I understand why. And she still gets on my case because she says, you make our house a mess, but you keep your place immaculate. You know, she's like, you coming home for the weekend is like a tornado that rolls through here. But anyways, the basic concept is this, that everything that you hear, see, smell, taste, or touch is an environment. And every environment is either adding energy to your life or draining energy from your life. So if you think about it, everything in your physical space, the computer that you write on, the desk you sit at, the chair that you sit in, the lamp that you know, have turned on, the pen that you write with, the notebooks you use, all of those things are physical objects that have emotions and memories associated with them. And as a result of memories and emotions being associated with them, they also have a certain energy that's associated with them. So, perfect example, you know, you might have stuff from a previous relationship that didn't work out with somebody, right? Like, I remember I used to write with a certain type of pen, and I realized, it was like, wow, this is an unconscious reminder of this person who really hurt me. No detriment to her as a person, but it's this perpetual reminder of something that's really negative in my life. Why do I have it in my physical environment? The way you dress is another example. So I make sure that every time some period of my life comes to an end, I change something. So, you know, recently my business partner, Brian, and I decided to part ways. My uniform to reduce decision fatigue and not have to think too much was just a black t-shirt and jeans. And I said, you know what? I think it's time to start dressing like a CEO. So I switched to like white Oxford dress shirts. And I was like, okay, you know what? This is much better looking. Like, I look, and it's amazing because even by doing something like that, you start to carry yourself differently. You know, people who work from home, often what they'll do is they'll kind of say, okay, I want to just putz around in my pajamas or whatever because I work from home. But even something as simple as changing the way that you dress, it changes the way that you carry yourself. I mean, if you're a woman and you've ever gotten dressed up to go out to like a really nice dinner, you know this. Like, you carry yourself differently, you feel more attractive. And as a result, your behavior changes. Like, you everything about your interactions changes. But I'll finish it with a story that I think really sums it up. So when I first learned about this idea of environments, it was from this guy named Jim Bunch. And, you know, I'll send you a link, or you can link it up for your listeners. We did this episode called The Nine Environments That Make Up Your Life, right? And so he told me about this idea. And so you have, you know, your physical environment, you have your physical body, you have your social environment, which is the people that you're surrounded with. You have your mimetic environment, which is the information that you consume, which is something we should come back to, because there's a lot that I have to say about that. That's probably even more valuable. But I took this idea of the physical environment and I looked at my bookshelf. And I realized there were all these books that I actually didn't find inspiring. And most of them were books about social media marketing. And I was like, okay, none of these books are representative of who I am today or who I want to be. And I got rid of them. And I just, you know, I put them away or donated them. And when I looked at the top shelf, the overwhelming majority of the books left were published by Penguin. And 2 weeks later, an editor at Penguin emailed me asking if I wanted to publish a book with them. So it's kind of taking the Marie Kondo life-changing magic of tidying up idea and just pushing it to a whole other level and applying that concept, not just to your physical spaces, but to everything.
Everything. I mean, and that's something that I live by. So I love that you bring this up because I think a lot of people are not conscious to it, that you are an energetic being. Everything impacts you and your energy. And they're either adding to it or taking away from it. And some of it can be very obvious. Like if you have toxic people in your life, get them out because that's impacting your energy. But some things are really subtle. Like you said, a pen that came from someone who broke your heart, or even little things. Because I remember my mother said this to me because she's very up in the feng shui biz. But she came over, and when she was trying to open up a door, you kind of had to hit it a little bit harder to pop it open. And she goes, you need to fix that. And I was like, what do you mean? She goes, like that frustrations, like that little bit of tension that you have just to open up a door to come into your home. Like this is your, you know, your sacred space. She didn't use that word. It's my word. But like, you know, this is like your sacred space. You want to have a very easy entrance into it and just feels good and it flows versus this like moment of tension before you walk in your home. So fix that. And then I started to notice all those little micro things in my environment where it's like, what do I have little bits of tension around? And, you know, whether if your closet's a mess or your bed's not made or you know, dishes left in the sink, that all impacts you in some way. Because even if you look over to it and you're like, ugh, boom, that's a moment of your energy shifting to a lower vibration instead of a higher one.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. So like, I dated this girl at the beginning of the year and I realized, I was like, oh, wow, the sheets that I have on my bed are from when I was seeing her. And I was like, okay, time to get rid of these sheets. Like, I it's a really small change, but, you know, I changed them back to like, you know, a black duvet cover. And suddenly I was like, wow, the room feels cleaner and lighter all of a sudden. Like, that's kind of amazing that it can, you know, have that impact. I think that we underestimate the impact of our environments on our behavior. But the beautiful thing is that, you know, we're talking about this in terms of getting rid of negative things, but this also can lead to a lot of positive changes too. I mean, all your habits and all your routines and everything you do on a daily basis is largely the byproduct of environment. And when you design the right environment, your behavior becomes automatic, so you don't have to depend on willpower. So like, I have framed principle, many of the people that I've interviewed, the ones who I really look up to, on my wall, because I want the environment that I'm doing my creative work in to be inspiring. I want it to be representative of not just who I am today, but who I want to become.
Ooh, I love it. I love that you say that. I actually interviewed a friend, Garen Jones, and I was doing all these Insta stories of his house, but he has this one room that it's got Oprah, the Dalai Lama, Martin Luther King, and he has all the inspirational people around with quotes from them. And you go in that room and you can't help but feel like inspired and empowered, and it shifts again, like the energy or like what. And what I love that you mentioned, it's not just people who you're inspired by, but who you want to become, because that's the key, is like our becoming, right? It's like our next creation of whatever we're going to make in life requires a different level of who we are and how we show up. And so having those reminders of like, okay, who do I need to be in this moment? How do I need to shift my thinking, my behaviors, my habits in order to elevate and get to the next level? Because again, I can't create this next iteration with the same iteration of self. I love that you have that in there.
It's one of the few exceptions to the idea that you can't make an internal change by changing something external. I think the one exception to that is your environment. Like if you make changes to your environment, your external environment, you will start to experience internal shifts. And they don't have to be like these crazy, like, you know, massive, like buy yourself a McMansion and like a Tesla type of changes. Even if you have the crappiest car in the world, just the fact that you wash it and maintain it on a regular basis will make a world of difference.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, I want to kind of highlight something back when we were talking about when you kind of went into your downward spiral, when everything crashed, and then how you pulled yourself out of it. Obviously, you ended up getting a book deal, which is so fantastic, from Penguin. But were there other things that you did in that time to support yourself in moving past that time?
Yeah, there are a ton of things, and there a lot of the practices that were put into Audience of One were the result of the things that I learned during that period. So, you know, earlier I alluded to the idea of your information environment, right? So environments were actually the starting point for all this change. Getting rid of anything that reminded me of this painful period from the past, even in the smallest ways, you know. So like for a while I changed the color of the Moleskine notebooks that I wrote. I'd been using black ones and I just started ordering colored ones. Minor change, but you know, that was a starting point. But I think the other thing is, then I started to really look at my behavior on the internet, because I feel like I'm beating a dead horse with this because I feel like I may be responsible for the demise of Facebook, and I'm sure Mark Zuckerberg will hate me for it, but whatever. He's probably never going to meet me anyways. I think that, and I've said this, you know, so many times in the process of being interviewed about Audience One, I think we've done a great disservice to our society by allowing social media to create this artificial sense of celebrity, this sense of constantly needing to compare. And not only that, the fact that these tools are engineered to be completely addictive and really kind of prey on the vulnerability of our brain chemistry. I think it's really telling when you have the people who worked on building something won't go near their own creations, and they say this thing is ripping apart the fabric of society. That's like, that should be a major red flag and a warning sign to all of us that we should not take using these things lightly, even though they're, you know, such big parts of our lives and have become really habitual. So reducing my use of technology was a big one, and really understanding what my behavior around technology was, particularly because, like I said, you know, having had this long distance relationship thing, what I realized was it wasn't the relationship. It was the constant dopamine surge of like one text after another, one Facebook message after another. That was what I think really caused a good amount of the depression. Because, I mean, I only met this person 3 times in person, so it didn't make any sense that you would have that kind of a reaction. But what you're, yeah, I mean, what we can do with social media is we can create this illusion of connection. And so I became hyper aware of that. And so I started to really watch the amount of time that I was spending on the internet, particularly, you know, places like Facebook and places like Instagram. And the funny thing is, my theories about this just became more and more validated in the last 2 years as people like Cal Newport have become vocal critics of social media. And bit by bit, I think we're all beginning to say, okay, you know what, like, what we're paying, you know, the price we're paying for access to being connected to our friends is our mental health. That's a really high price to pay for a tool that allows you to connect to people. And in all honesty, like, I think that really, I think there's a real ethical question of if, you know, the profitability of your business depends on the mental health of your users, that really raises a question of where is your moral compass in all of this? And I think it's worse for younger people too, particularly because of the fact that they've just kind of grown up with this as their default. So you have this prioritization of what, you know, the author David Brooks calls resume values over eulogy values. You know, you have some exorbitant number of like young kids who want to be famous, and you know, it's kind of silly because you live in a world where you can be famous for being famous. It's the stupidest thing ever. You know, it's like it's like Paris Hilton is famous for being rich.
Well, and
she hasn't really
didn't she have a video?
Although
well.
She's built businesses, like yeah. I think she's you know,
she's
I think she doesn't
now.
Get the credit she deserves in a lot of ways. But at the same time, like she's also created this culture of being famous for being famous. So that was part of it. Is really looking at that. Then sleep and diet were big ones. Diet. I mean, I grew up in an Indian family, so I have no right to talk about healthy diets. Like we eat carbs and, you know, food that's rich and butter and all that stuff. So, you know, like our whole diet is carbs. But like I tried very hard to adjust diet. So I'm probably not the person to talk about that. But I think the one place that I really had to make another adjustment was looking at how I managed sleep. So sleep is one of those things that you don't understand how critical it is to your well-being until you actually are deprived of it. You know, I was waking up in the middle of the night with heart palpitations for like 3 or 4 months straight, and you get stuck in this very vicious cycle because you can't sleep because you're depressed, and you're depressed because you can't sleep. And it just sucks. There's like nothing like it. So I finally went and saw a doctor and, you know, got put on antidepressants to help me sleep. And so balancing out sleep was one of the things, but then looking at what your behavior is like before you sleep. And I was just writing about this morning, because how you end today will have a huge impact on how you start tomorrow. If you spend the end of your day checking email, browsing the web, uploading pictures to Instagram, or scrolling through the Facebook newsfeed, you are going to start the day with a self-imposed handicap, because the last thing you want to do when you're about to go to sleep is rev up your nervous system when you should be winding it down. And that's precisely what we do when we do all of those things, is we're revving up the nervous system, you know, at a time before we go to sleep. And I remember one of my old mentors used to tell me, he's like, dude, he's like, you shouldn't be watching 24 before you go to sleep. I mean, watching Jack Bauer, you know, try to defuse a nuclear bomb, probably not going to put you in the most restful state. Although I do love 24 and, you know, it is super addictive, but that's a whole other, you know, conversation. So yeah, I mean, sleep was one of those things, but really understanding sleep hygiene and saying, okay, like what is my behavior? So I try to keep a rule of turning off most of my devices by about 8 o'clock at night. I do play video games, but I don't find watching TV or playing video games is as bad as looking at your phone or your computer because of the fact that you don't get that sort of, you know, blue light. And really, I think setting up your sleeping environment so that it is like a sanctuary for sleep. The only thing that sucks right now is that the place that I work and the place that I sleep have to be the same because I live in a 2-bedroom apartment. But yeah, those are big ones. And then I think, you know, watching the people that I was surrounding myself with, I had to be mindful of who I was letting into my life. And in a lot of cases, that meant the end of a lot of friendships of people who, you know, who felt that, you know, okay, you're down, I'm going to kick you when you're down. See, and here's the thing that people don't get is, you know, if you kick somebody when they're down, that's how they're going to remember you when they get back up.
Ooh, that's right. That's right. Wow.
So, you know, I can't say it was any one thing that just pulled me out of it. It was like a combination of factors, and it was doing a little bit at a time. And then, of course, everybody knows, I think this is no surprise, that exercise is one of those things that immediately alters your mood. I think that if you go from the thing with exercise is, I've said this before, if you're stuck mentally, move physically. Like, that is one of those things that I think it just becomes very obvious. It's obvious to me when I get out of the water. You know, like last Friday, I was supposed to meet up with a friend and all my plans got canceled and I was feeling down. I was like, well, it's 4:30. I think I'll go hit the CrossFit gym. And I noticed, I was like, okay, surfed in the morning, went to CrossFit by 8:30. I was in bed and, you know, not upset at all that my plans were canceled for the night. I was like, cool, I'm good.
I'm good. Yeah. And you know, what is it? Emotions are energy in motion. You can get your body moving, you shift the energy, you shift the emotional state. So that's so important. Something I wanted to touch on as well, when you talked about the sleep hygiene, I totally know how painful it can be when you're not sleeping. Like, I had health issues earlier this year. I was waking up around midnight till 5 a.m. Sometimes it would be 3 or 4 or 5, but times that by 2 months. I hit a space where I was falling into depression and even having some suicidal ideations. Your brain just is like not in the right place.
It's a mess.
Holy crap. But it was really wearing on me. And it was because, I guess, at different points of time when you're sleeping, certain organs are repairing themselves. So if the organ has a difficult time healing in that moment, it wakes you up. Because it's needing your, so that was what was going on for me, but it was really, really, really difficult. So sleep is so essential to just being able to emotionally regulate yourself throughout the day. So,
and it's one of the ultimate forms of self-care that we don't prioritize nearly enough in a culture of like hustle and crush it. And I think the other thing is, right, particularly for men in our culture, like they see things like an Elon Musk who works 120 hours a week, and they're like, they mix up causation and correlation. Or, you know, like, I think in one of Gary Vaynerchuk's books, he says, okay, well, whatever, you have a job, you know, that you have, you know, until 10 p.m. He said, stay up until 2 a.m. doing whatever you're working on. Like, most people would die if they did that. You know, and yet that to believe that we should perpetuate this kind of message is ridiculous. And I mean, I know, you know, particularly with somebody like Elon Musk, because I've interviewed his ex-wife, Justine. Yeah, you don't realize that that's not a sustainable way to operate for most people. And I think that it just creates really, really unhealthy, unrealistic expectations of what you're capable of and puts unnecessary pressure on yourself.
Yeah, no, I agree. And really, you got to find your own groove. Like, people will give you different ways of how they do life that work for them. And then you take what works for you and let the rest go, because
precisely. You got to think in frameworks, not formulas. And the problem is that it's very tempting in the world that we live in. What most people do is they look at somebody who's a figure of authority and they treat their advice as gospel, not guidance.
Yeah. And it's always guidance. One other thing I want to tap into that you said about the sleep thing, and about turning off all the social media. You know, I am a hypnotherapist. And one key thing that I talk to all my clients about, I say, look, at least 30 minutes. I mean, I love that you shut everything off at 8. I think that's even better. But, you know, about 30 minutes before you go to sleep and 30 minutes when you wake up, you're actually in a natural hypnotic state. Your brain waves are in theta. So that's when you're most suggestible to things, even to yourself, the thoughts that you're having or to outside stuff. And so if you're looking at social media and you're comparing yourself or feeling bad about yourself or whatever the negative thing usually is when we're staring at social media or watching 24 and seeing people get murdered on television or whatever that might be, this is actually going into your subconscious. And then you go to sleep and you're marinating on it for, you know, 5 to 10 hours, depending on how long you sleep for. And that's going in deeper and deeper, which is why in your morning you get affected by it too. And what happens usually when people wake up in the morning, they grab their devices again, first thing. And then boom, they're back into that same, mode. And it's really dangerous. So at least, you know, if you want to change your brain and change thinking patterns and even emotional states, you got to nip that now.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a piece about this saying that it was titled Starting Your Day on the Internet is Damaging Your Brain, because it literally is damaging your brain. And I literally don't turn on any devices. I use my phone for the Calm meditation app, and that's about it. And then I go and put it out of the room for the first couple hours of the day. Like, I don't need to use it for anything. I don't, you know, I don't read Kindle books or anything with screens. I read physical books, and I do a good amount of my writing by hand. So I don't turn on a computer for the first hour and a half of the day.
It's good. And it's good to, even for those listening, to not even have electronics in your room. I mean, they've been showing how those radio waves can start to damage even your body. So get it away. Like, I saw a study where they put a phone next to an apple, which think that that might be your head, because a lot of people put their phones on their nightstands or wherever. And the radiation that came from it was like damaging the apple quickly. And then and then you saw an apple that wasn't near a phone. So it was like this, you know, to show the difference. And that stuff, it's getting to you. So get electronics out of your room and create.
Yeah. I mean, it's our relationship with technology. I think it just is one of those things that needs to be more mindful and deliberate for many people. And unfortunately, it's just a default behavior at this point.
Yeah. So something that I know you mentioned earlier as well, when we were talking about creating environments, and you said that you create environments that support you in generating new habits. I know one of them is your writing, right? So you write 1,000 words every single day, which is absolutely incredible. And that's, you've built habits, and your book is also, or you have a program, right, about building habits. Mm-hmm. I would love for you to talk about that, because, you know, I know that our habits are what generate our results, and many people are programmed with habits that are blocking them from what they want. How do you build new habits to support you towards what it is that you want?
Yeah. Okay. So this is a big question. So, you know, one, I just published this piece on Medium this morning titled Habits Are Basically the Compound Interest of Self-Improvement. And I have to give James Clear credit for that, because he said that in an interview with me. And I was like, dude, I am totally using that as a title for a blog post. But the reason I said that is because we have to know why. Like you said, you know, your habits produce your results. Hence the reason your habits are basically the compound interest of self-improvement. The problem is that for most people, one, they don't think that habits are effective because they don't see a result immediately. But that's like, you know, in putting a dollar in your bank account that has compound interest and expecting it to see, you know, be $1 million tomorrow. That just doesn't happen. That's not how it works. But the thing is, if you can stick with something for long enough, eventually you'll start to see progress. But the other place that people go wrong is that they try to make really drastic and unsustainable changes. So perfect example is you go and you read some article on Medium, which makes you feel like you're a total loser because you don't meditate for 20 minutes a day. You're not vibrating at a high frequency or whatever new age bullshit, you know, somebody wrote in their blog post. And, you know, you don't write 1,000 words a day and you haven't built a company. So it's like, okay, well, shit, you know what? I'm going to become the type of person who does all of this stuff today. And so if you try to change everything at once, then you end up changing, like, nothing you change will stick, right? So the other thing is—
That's a practice in frustration.
Yeah, it really does. And so the other thing that people do is that they make even the attempt to make a small change extremely unsustainable. So if you're a person who's never written 1,000 words a day, so let's just use this example because it's the one that I'm most familiar with and I can, you know, give you the framework based on this habit. So let's say that, you know, you're like, okay, well, I like this idea. I want to write 1,000 words a day. But if you're a person who's never sat down to even write in the morning, that's a bit like going to the gym and saying, you know what, I've never lifted before. I think I'll start with 100-pound barbells. You're going to hurt yourself. Like, there's no way that that's going to turn out well. And it's kind of the same. I mean, you're not going to hurt yourself, but there's no way that you're going to go from never having written anything to writing 1,000 words on day one. So when we did this course called Finish What You Start a while back that we don't offer anymore. But one of the concepts that our content strategist Kingshug came up with was this idea of minimum viable actions. And he's always very quick to remind me. He's like, dude, he's like, you have to remember, he's the people you're teaching this to are not you. They don't have this all like wired. So we need to explain it to them in a way that makes sense. I was like, I don't understand why people can't just do this. He's like, trust me, they can't just do this. What he said made a lot of sense once we started looking at the behavioral science behind it, right? And this is what James Clear refers to as identity-based habit formation. So if you're you know, somebody who wants to write 1,000 words a day, rather than saying, okay, I want to write 1,000 words a day, it's worth saying, okay, what is the behavior of a person who writes 1,000 words a day? So what does Srini do in the morning, and what part of that could I model? So for example, one thing that I do every morning is I sit down at a desk and I crack open a notebook, and you say, okay, you know what? Instead of making the goal to write 1,000 words a day, I'm going to make my goal to crack open a notebook every single day. That's it. If I've cracked open the notebook, I've succeeded. Because the idea is basically that you want to kind of build a chain, right? Or kind of basically see progress by doing the smallest possible thing that you can do. And what will happen is the inertia from doing that small thing will actually cause you to follow through on the habit. Because if you sit down for 5 days in a row and you crack open a notebook, at one of those days, eventually you're going to think, well, you know, I might as well write something. And, you know, so then you say, okay, well, now I've gotten the habit of, you know, sitting down to crack open a notebook. Let me see if I can do 3 sentences today. And if you can do 3 sentences, great. Then what you do is you keep gradually raising the level of intensity. You keep pushing it to the point where you feel resistance. And as you raise the level of intensity, you say, okay, well, I don't feel any resistance to 3 sentences. Let me see if I can do 6. Okay, I can do 6. And then the other thing that I think that you have to really do is look at this through the lens of a system, not a goal, a process, not an outcome. Okay, because to this day, and I've told numerous people this, 90% of everything I write is just absolute shit. It's not readable. It's not meant for public consumption. But the thing is, I just write so much of it that inevitably some of it ends up being usable. And that's really what it comes down to, because, you know, they've done studies where they've looked at people who have sort of the big, you know, most number of creative breakthroughs. And the thing that people who are, you know, most creative have in common is that they create a lot. Like, volume is one of the greatest predictors of quality in terms of creative output, because when you're doing something consistently, you're inevitably going to get better at it. So you can keep gradually raising the level of intensity until you get to the point where you're like, okay, well, now I can write 1,000 words, no problem. And the other thing is, part of why I like the idea of 1,000 words is that there's literally no room for argument whether I've managed to accomplish the goal or not. Like, it's very clear. It's like, you either hit the number or you don't. And so that takes a lot of pressure off, because you're like, okay, I can write 1,000 words. That's it. I'm not trying to write the next great American novel. I'm not trying to become a bestseller. I'm not trying to accomplish anything, which takes us back to the very beginning of our conversation, that's completely out of my control. Everything in this situation is completely in my control. So, like, even, you know, the example of going to the gym, right? I can control the number of times I decide to go to CrossFit for a week, how my body's going to respond to what I eat. Yeah, maybe it won't respond the way I want it to on certain days. And, you know, there'll be days where I cave because I like chocolate lava cake and ice cream. And so I will, you know, if I'm like, okay, you know what? Like, and then that's the weird thing about working out consistently. Sometimes it becomes your justification for eating something
exactly
shitty.
Right. You're like, I'm doing this so I can have lava cake tonight.
Exactly. But then, you know, you get to this point where you've got inertia. And the other thing is, eventually, once you start to see progress, because the other thing is, I would say, is also have some visible marker of the progress that you're making. So right now, you know, I have 3 jars on my desk, all of which have marbles in them. So for every day that I write something, every day that I follow through on 1,000 words, I put a marble in the jar. For every day that I spend an hour reading, for every hour, I put a marble in the jar for reading. And then for every article, I put a marble in the jar. So, like, basically what you're seeing there is visible progress. And the reason that's important, that's my method of doing it. You could literally just cross off check boxes or, you know, do to don't break the chain calendar. The idea basically is that you want to create visible progress, because when you start to see that progress, you're going to keep feeling motivated to come back the next day and do it again. And so you add all these combinations together, and that's how you develop the habit. One last thing is the idea of environment, which we were talking about earlier. So Sean Acord, in his book, The Happiness Advantage, talked about this principle called activation energy, which is the number of steps between you and the thing that you want to do. And for the things that you want to follow through on, you want to reduce the activation energy. For the things you want to avoid, you want to increase the activation energy. So in the case of something like a writing habit, the way you reduce the activation energy is, instead of, you know, waiting to get your notebook out and your pen out the morning of, or when you're going to do, you know, writing, you put all that stuff out the night before. So that way, when you sit down in your space, you've reduced the activation energy. Just by eliminating those number of steps, you increase the likelihood that you're going to follow through on this thing, just because of the fact that the environment is designed to be conducive to the behavior you want. Not only that, because of the fact that you've done all of those things in advance, what you're doing is you're avoiding having to make decisions, which every decision you make depletes your willpower. So every time you decide what book you're going to read, what links you're going to click on, what emails you're going to respond to, every one of these little things adds up, leading to decision fatigue and worse decisions, and kind of it just kind of, you know, kind of shoots your cognitive load down, like, you know, so that you don't have the cognitive capacity to focus on the thing that you want to do. So what you're doing is you're basically tapping into all these parts of behavioral science and the way the brain is wired and kind of just tricking your brain into a lot of different things. One last thing I'll give you, and this is basically called success accelerants, again, from Sean Acor's work. Like, I took happiness research and I adapted it to you know, how to use it for this purpose. But so your brain makes progress towards a goal based on the perceived distance to that goal. And I realized when I was first writing 1,000 words from a blank page seemed really daunting. So what I did was I actually would just find a quote from something I was reading, even maybe a paragraph. So suddenly you're not looking at a blank page. At least you've got something to work with. And what that does is it kind of tricks your brain and it makes the perceived distance from where you're starting to 1,000 words seem smaller. And as a result, you'll get to the 1,000 words faster. I mean, at this point, I consistently blow past the word count of 1,000 words. So that's kind of all of it in a nutshell. I know it's a lot to digest. I mean, I've written a ton about this everywhere online. Like, my entire Medium body of work is about this kind of stuff. But the gist of it is really, you know, set up the right environment. Make it impossible for yourself to fail, like by taking the most minimal viable action possible, and then keep gradually raising the intensity of what you're doing. I think one final sort of caveat to all of this is looking at the purpose and meaning behind this, right? Don't go out and try to develop this habit just because somebody like me says you should, or some stupid article on the internet says that, oh, you know, 1,000 words a day changed my life. If you don't give a shit about becoming a writer, then you should probably not waste your time with this. But the thing that I think is what I like about this is we're talking about this in terms of one habit, but it could be applied to virtually anything you want to do.
Mm-hmm. No, I love that. And then that's the thing is, like, for people, they have different habits within themselves that they want to achieve, but it's the getting started and staying motivated. I mean, motivation's false anyway, but it's like, how can they create the environments to support them and actually having the new habit actualized in their life as well.
Totally.
And finding out why it's important to you, which I had a question for you earlier, and I was just curious, this went back to your events when you were saying that you're always wanting to get, I know, like, the, what is it, the Zappos, one of their values is like shock and awe, or like the awe, right? And I feel like that's kind of you. It's like, how do we create the awe for people?
Totally.
Do you think you're generating that from a place of, like, what's the motivation behind that? Because I don't know, I'll just speak for myself, but being Asian, yeah. It's like, it's always a what's next and what's better. And for me, a lot of my old stuff is like, how do I keep proving that I'm enough? And it's about mm-hmm. then over delivering or making sure that others think it's good. Is your motivation, what's your motivation to constantly need to next level and awe people?
So that's a fair question. I think, you know, having been raised Indian, you and I probably have a bit of that in common.
Unconscious.
But yeah. The thing is, I don't think when it comes to my creative work, I mean, my parents don't listen to my podcast. You know, I don't know that they've read, my dad, you know, listened to the audiobook of my last book. I'm pretty sure they haven't actually read this new one yet. And so I think for me, more than anything, my friend AJ Leon used to say, he's like, you know, he likes to create beautiful things because beautiful things are what the world deserves. And so I think a part of it is that I want to create things that are that I'm proud to put my signature on. I think for me, it's always looking at my own expectations and saying, okay, how could I wow myself with this because it's so cool? And if other people happen to think that, that's just a convenient byproduct. I think that, no doubt, like, you know, I don't think it's not from a place of seeking validation from our audience as much as it is we want to give them something that is so memorable and so unforgettable that they'll forever be moved by it. You know, I mean, even when we do something like have a free ebook, like we have this free ebook called The Compass, and it looks nothing like a free ebook should look. I mean, it's so far above and beyond what an average free ebook looks like. And, you know, we spent almost $1,500 putting it together, which is a terrible use of resources. You should never do that. But still, like, you look at it and you're like, okay, this is way cool. And, like, I mean, I saw how AJ did that with a lot of the stuff that he did. He has this, if you've never read it, this is definitely worthwhile, is The Life and Times of a Remarkable Misfit. It'll take you like probably 40 minutes to read the whole thing. And I mean, I think that is one of the most life-changing pieces of work I've ever read. And it's a free PDF. But once you see something like that as a free PDF, your whole standard changes. So I think part of it is about it's about basically exceeding the standards that you have for yourself constantly and just pushing to see if what you did before can exceed what you did previously. So same thing with interviews, right? I'm always looking to see, okay, how could I do better the next go around? You know, like, we might have an interview that somebody says was amazing, and I'll go back and say, okay, well, what wasn't amazing about this? Like, how could we have done this differently? You know, what did I miss? So I did an interview with Danielle Laporte for Creative Live recently, and yeah, and I remember afterwards we got done, and you know, Drew, the producer, was like, how'd you think that went? I was like, I thought it went phenomenal, because it's Danielle. It always goes phenomenal. But I went back and I listened. I was like, oh, wow, I missed a thread that I wish I had asked about. Like, I realized I missed something, you know, really small. It's stuff like that. It's constantly going back and willing to say, okay, what would take me from proficiency to mastery to basically what Cal Newport would say is so good they can't ignore you.
Yep. No, I love that. And that goes back also to what the whole unmistakable creative, right? It's like creating something, being your own individual self, elevating mm-hmm. the bar to create a masterpiece. And I really love what you share. And I could just tell from who you are also, Srini, that you really care about providing value to the people that you're serving in some way, whatever you're putting out there, even if it's free content, that you're going to want, you want to make sure that it's of high value and high production. So
yeah, no, I mean, it's, I think that the part of it is, I think we're also in a time when the bar has just been raised, you know, because of the fact that we have access to tools, resources, distribution channels, and everything that we've never had before. And you can go from idea to execution in a matter of minutes. You've got a lot of people who you're competing for, you know, people's attention in a sea of noise, and you've got to find a way to stand out. And I think quality is the way to do that. And I don't think people put nearly enough thought and effort into that.
Huge. Yep. That's, I'm a big believer in quality for sure. Cause you see things thrown together and it's like,
yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, there are things that I put out in the world where I'm like, okay, this could have been better. It, like, it's a balancing act, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah.
So you've interviewed a lot of people. Over 700. We were trying to figure out before we started rolling what was the number for you. You're like, I lost count after 700, which is absolutely amazing that you've done so many podcast interviews. I'm going to put you on my wall, Srini, and be like, one day I'm going to become like Srini.
Well, you know what happens when people put people like me on walls, right? Like, I mean, that's what the North Koreans do with Kim Jong-un. So maybe you should rethink that.
Okay, I will. But maybe I'll still have a little picture of you on my wall. Of all the
people. Which I'll be flattered by.
We'll see. And I'll like screenshot and be like, hey, look at this. Getting to 700. But of all those people who you have interviewed, what are some key, I guess, lessons, like the ones that stand out the most for you that you've integrated into your life that have made a difference?
Well, so there are a couple of ways we can take this. Do you want me to talk about lessons in the art of interviewing or life lessons that I've learned from the people? Okay. So that's a tough one because it's a landmine of information. I remember I wrote, and you may have read it. I wrote this piece titled What We Should Have Learned in School But Never Did on Medium that went like crazy viral. And I'm trying to get my agent to, you know, like buy into the fact that this should be my next book. But the ongoing joke at Unmistakable Creative is that whoever this week's guest is a reflection of some problem that I'm trying to solve in my life. So for a while it was like, wow, there've been a lot of dating experts lately. It's like, clearly you have some relationship problems. Like, well, none of those problems are still solved. So as I told you, like, as far as lessons learned, if I could implement everything, it'd be easy. But I'll give you some of the really sort of broad themes that have stood out. I think that one of the big ones is the fact that you cannot solve internal problems with external solutions, with the exception of what I told you about environments. So often we're trying to solve our emotional problems or emotional voids by some sort of accomplishment, by having some other person come into our lives. And that very rarely works. It's a recipe for disaster. So, you know, that I think lesson has been just reinforced over and over and over again. I think that when you look at the people that I talk to, they have in a lot of ways, a almost delusional view of reality in a good way, a way that somehow allows them to balance sort of a delusional view of reality, but also the ability to execute within the boundaries of that reality. So actually this is what it is that the people that I talk to, and one of the big lessons I think that I've learned from everybody, and Justine Musk summed this up so beautifully, and I'll tell you exactly what she said, but I think that when you look at the people who come to Unmistakable Creative, their worldview is that reality is malleable. It's not fixed. And Justine Musk said of Elon Musk, he has the ability to take the world that is in his head and impose it on the world around him until it looks like the world is in his head. And I was like, well, that's a reality distortion field if I've ever heard one. And so I think everybody, not to the degree that he does, but everybody I talk to probably has possessed that. The other thing is that I think that, you know, when you look at the idea of reality not being fixed, then you kind of say, okay, well, if reality is not fixed and reality is malleable, then, you know, the self is also malleable. Like, we can become very different versions of than the people that we are today. So, you know, if you talk to me, as I mentioned to you at Berkeley, you probably would have hated my guts. Like, chances are, who knows, maybe.
Yeah, we both, you guys, we both went to Cal. We're both Berkeley.
We would not be having this conversation, that's for sure, because I was constantly stressed out and worried about everything. And I was just, you know, I was a very different person. Like, I, you know, I was a person who stayed up partying and drinking until 2 a.m. You know, I used to smoke cigarettes when I drank. Like, it was like, I'm not at all that person now. But I think that what I got to see was that you could actually make a lot of drastic behavioral changes in your life and become a very different person and produce results that seemed completely just, you know, out of left field. And then I think at its core, this is a really big one, and this is really, really hard. I think you can probably relate to this because you come from an Asian family, but, you know, so many of us live our lives according to other people's expectations. Like, you know, what do our parents expect of us? What does society expect of us? What are friends going to think? Like, I mean, one of the most common things you'll hear growing up in an Indian culture is, oh God, what are people going to think? You know, like, I lived at my parents' house for 8 years, which, believe me, does nothing for your dating life. And, you know, it, and at the same time, like, there's this constant feeling, even though if it wasn't explicitly spoken, of God, what do people think? Like, what do people think of the fact that our son lives at our house and he's almost 40 years old, and, like, you know, people around him are starting families and having kids and buying houses? And you start to kind of realize that, okay, I think this is the big thing that, as much as it's not easy to accept, is that other people are not going to live with the consequences of the choices that you make in your life. So one of the things that I remember feeling very stressed out about was the fact that I was watching my parents get older, and I kept thinking, I was like, what if a parent or two is not there if I get married or have kids? Like, that idea was terrifying to me. And so two things came from that. I talked to a guy named Frank Ostaseski, who was the director of the Zen Hospice Project, who said, well, he's like, don't let that be an excuse for not spending time with your parents now. So I go home for dinner every Sunday now. And that's been kind of awesome. Like, it's been fantastic, because my mom is a really good cook, and she sends me back to Cardiff with, like, you know, a truckload of Indian food. But I think that, you know, you start to become aware of the fact that, okay, yeah, that might happen, but at the end of the day, you're going to be the person who has to live with all the consequences of the choices that you make, not the people who judge you for making those choices.
They're not even thinking about you most of the time anyway. I mean, they might judge you the second they see your Facebook post, and then 2 seconds later, they're thinking about their own crap about themselves. And we think, exactly. Like, what's that saying that's like, who are we to be so narcissistic to think that others are thinking about us all the time? They're not.
Yeah, well, and there's that. And, you know, and we live in a culture, there's this really great book that I just finished reading called Selfie, How We Became Obsessed with Ourselves and What It's Doing to Us, which I think everybody should read. Like, I would say that is the most important book I've read this entire year. But yeah, I mean, there's that point. And then I think that one thing I would say, and, you know, like, I'm trying to summarize 700 interviews for you in, you know, a couple of minutes and a couple of sentences. And, you know, it's a landmine of information. Anybody who has ever kind of dug into our archive knows it's kind of like, okay, welcome to being unplugged from the matrix. Like, you're about to see a world that is very different than you're used to seeing. I think that if I look at it at its core, my mission and message in my life, I realize, is basically to go and undo people's social programming, because mine failed me so poorly, so miserably. And, you know, like, despite going to Berkeley, like, I was like, okay, if this is the path to a wonderful and successful life, I'm like, why did I get fired from every job? Why was I so miserable at all the things I did? I did all the right things that you're supposed to do according to society, and none of them worked. So it made me realize that, okay, maybe our social programming is bullshit. But I would say, at its core, if you were to basically take all of the messages from everybody on Unmistakable Creative, it comes down to this one idea, is that your social programming is not an accurate reflection of your reality or what's possible with your life.
Agree. And I think part of life is going on to that journey to discover, who am I really? Once I release all the social programming, like, what actually lights me up, what feels aligned for me, instead of what I've been told or what I think I should do or how to keep up with the Joneses and all that stuff. Yeah.
And that's not easy to do, because of the fact that, as you know, on the one hand, you get constantly exposed to messages of undoing your social programming, which in and of themselves are a form of social programming, right? It's really kind of crazy, because it's basically looking at saying, okay, even I had a really tough time with this for a while because my standard for what success looked like was based entirely on people that I interviewed until somebody told me, like, you're basing your version of reality on outliers, not normal people. And so that when that becomes your basis for comparison, it's kind of ridiculous because I've talked to billionaires and I've talked to, you know, artists, and you forget that, oh, yeah, by the way, some of these people can't do what I do and vice versa. So yeah, I think that that's really at its core. If you, you know, kind of go down this rabbit hole, what you'll start to see is that you just, we've seen parents who, you know, homeschool their children using our content. We have therapists who counsel their patients. It's a really bizarre sort of thing we would have never predicted. But yeah, at its core, that's what I would say is the ultimate lesson.
I love it. Yeah. And then the piece that you said about create your own reality, you know, and, you have the opportunity to shift that and change at any time. And it's about building those new habits that then create a new reality for you. And the habit, the biggest habit is the way you use this guy, right? Your thinking. Yeah. So, Srini, I could go on and on, but I got to close this out. So I got a few more questions for you that I ask all my guests at the end of each show. The first is, what is something unique about you that most people don't know?
I played the tuba for 9 years. I don't know that most people don't know that, but yeah, I was, it's come out in a handful of interviews, but yeah, I made All-State Band 3 years in a row. I was accepted to the USC School of Music. And then of course, Indian parents were like, you're not going to be a professional musician, but I'm glad they talked me out of that.
Can you still play? Like if I were to hand you a tuba, could you still rock it?
No, I mean, in all honesty, would you want me to serenade you with a tuba or a guitar?
No, guitar. Okay, cool. Guitar. when you're in a really dark place, what's your go-to to get out?
I think exercise and surfing are the two. Once I, you know, do all the stupid things that most people do, like go get drunk or numb the pain somehow.
Perfect. And knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your 10-year-old self?
Oof, wow. Oh, this is it. You don't just have to choose from the options that are put in front of you. That is like the biggest lie that we have ever been told. And you know where that became very obvious to me is when I looked back at Berkeley and you're told these are the majors, these are the jobs that these majors lead to, and these are your options, which is bullshit. Because if there's anything that I learned from the experience of going to Berkeley, I had a friend who, as you know from this experience, classes are super impacted. Like even if you work your ass off in high school to get in, then you have to work your ass off again just to get into your major. It's insane.
Just to get classes. Telebears was the most inefficient system.
Like ridiculous.
Dialing to get your class.
This was like long before, you know, you could do everything online. Like the internet was literally being invented during this time. So anyways, I had a friend who didn't get into the business school and he decided to just take all of the classes that he needed for a business major. And 2 months before graduation, he walked into the dean's office at the business school and said, I didn't get into Haas. I have all my credits and graduation is in a month. Are you going to let me graduate? And she had she was livid because she was, but that is somebody saying your reality is completely malleable. These rules are not real and you don't have to choose from the options in front of you. He literally worked the system to the point where he pissed off the dean and still managed to get out of there. He got to walk with a business school, even though he didn't get into the damn business school. Like that was one of the smartest things I'd ever seen.
Genius. I love it. Yep. You don't have to choose from the options that are given you. Srini, thank you so much for sharing.
Awesome.
I love this. Could go on and on. Maybe I should do a Joe Rogan show where we're on for like 2 hours. the guy just sits there and talks about it. Like, I've tried to listen, just I need shorter snippets. But you have shared so much wisdom, so many powerful, practical tools. I encourage the listeners, go back and even listen to the habit piece and how, like, take notes and mark that off. And if there's a habit that you've been struggling to create, take those steps. But there's so much other goodness in the episode. So thank you, thank you, thank you for being on the show and sharing your heart and sharing your wisdom.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This was fun.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. I really loved how Srini talked about the power of presence. It is so important. And it's so true how the ocean and actually nature can teach us how to live in a more peaceful and harmonious way within ourselves and in our environments. So if you don't already, if you just stop and really pay attention to how Mama Nature works, you'll start to see that there are so many lessons on how to live life from a place of flow, from a place of trust, from a place of allowing, where we're not blocking what is already meant to be.
because a flower just knows to bloom into a flower. It doesn't judge itself for being, you know, too tall, too short, whatever colors. It just allows life to flow. And of course, there's so many other messages when we just pay attention to how nature is. Now, in this episode, you know, we also talked about the trap of comparison, as well as being able to move through the disappointments when our expectations aren't met. And a lot of healing or releasing of those mental paradigms can happen when we own our worth and hold a deep love and trust inside of ourselves. So if you want support with deepening your self-love, if you have not already done it, you want to download my free self-love kickstart. Now, I don't know what you're waiting for if you haven't downloaded it, because it's awesome. And I share some powerful practices to support you in owning your worth and opening up to your own love to radically transform your life. So I put a lot of heart into creating it to get you on the track to develop a more loving relationship with yourself, to heal and give you access to everything that you desire. So if you want that, make sure you go download this free self-love kickstart that I created just for you at stephaniekwong.com/self-love-kickstart. Now, if you enjoyed this episode and you want to make sure that you do not miss any new episodes coming out, make sure you subscribe to the podcast. And if it feels aligned for you, I would be so deeply grateful if you'd leave me a 5-star review on iTunes, because that means we can support even more people to rise higher together. Okay, my friends, if you want to connect with Srini, head on over to the show notes over at stephaniekwong.com/EP36, where you'll find all the links to connect with Srini, and you can find the links to check out his podcast too. Alrighty, until next time, I'm sending you so much love.